This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cardiologist Ross Simpson has spent years studying premature sudden death. Now, that's when an adult with no obvious pre-existing conditions dies seemingly out of the blue. And while he was able to learn quite a bit about these patients' bodies and medical history, he knew almost nothing about their day-to-day lives. He decided to look outside the box for answers. So what does he do? He calls an oral historian. That phone call led him to Rachel Seidman. She's the director of the Southern Oral History Program at the UNC Center for the Study of the American South. And the two are now working on a new research initiative called Stories to Save Lives. It aims to bring the research methodology of oral history into the realm of healthcare to better understand how North Carolinians think about and act on their health. Joining me now to preview the project is Rachel Seidman. She's an adjunct professor of history and women's and gender studies at the UNC Chapel Hill, and someone we check in with now and then about the Southern Oral History Program. Rachel, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me back.
Also with us, Dr. Ross Simpson, a cardiologist and a professor of medicine at the UNC School of Medicine, and also the project leader for SUDDEN, a research program that investigates sudden death in adults. Dr. Simpson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about your research into premature sudden death. Maybe we want to learn a little bit more about that before we talk about this project.
Well, thank you. We wanted to understand why people die before their time. And one of the things we found working with emergency medical services in Wake County was that about 10 to 15% of adults die suddenly, unexpectedly. And we have learned quite a bit about the underlying diseases that they have, like hypertension, diabetes, obesity. But we knew nothing about why these people weren't seeing the doctor, or if they saw the doctor, why weren't they taking medicines that could have saved their lives? So that's where we are. We really have been very successful in understanding about the diseases the people have, underlying diseases, their lack of medical treatment or their ineffective medical treatment. But we do nothing that would guide us on how to prevent the deaths.
I mean, it's interesting because there are a number of data points that you could have tried to correlate. How often did they see a doctor? What were the underlying medical issues? But at some point, you decided that narrative, oral history, was going to be a part of this. When did you come to that idea?
Well, we're very compulsive in medicine, as you probably have guessed. And we correlated all those data points that you just suggested. For example, we found that some people don't see the doctor at all, but a good third of them see the doctor a lot. And yet both group, people even who see the doctor, don't seem to be on statins. They don't seem to be on blood pressure medicines. They don't seem to be on medicines, aspirin. You know, these are things that can save lives. And so it was a mystery to us. And we tried this with multiple correlations, as you suggested. And we certainly found out a lot about the diseases, but we didn't find out much about how we could work with people to prevent a sudden death.
What led you to call the Oral History Project?
Well, I have to, a couple things. One is we had reached a dead end, mm-hmm. and so I wanted some help. I called other departments at UNC, and Rachel was the first group who was enthusiastic and thought she might be able to help. And she did.
Rachel, tell us about that phone call.
I was really stunned when Dr. Simpson called me. I mean, the idea of a cardiologist calling a historian and asking for help was novel, shall we say. And but I was really actually thrilled by that, by the idea of a colleague at UNC who was curious in that kind of way outside a disciplinary box. And I remember I went over to his office and we sat down and talked, and there was just an immediate kind of connection to people who were really interested in trying to solve a problem together across these boundaries of the sciences and the humanities. And so I was excited about it. I said, you know, I don't know if I can help you, but I'd like to try to find out.
The Oral History Project has an archive, obviously. So you've got all of these tape-recorded conversations. How did you think about how they could possibly inform this question, and how do you even go about searching?
Well, I knew that part of what Dr. Simpson was interested in were questions about, you know, where do people get information from, or who do they trust? How do they think about health and their lives in relationship to other people, or perhaps to religion, or you know, other things? And I knew that we, as you said, the Southern Oral History Program has close to 6,000 interviews that have been done over the last 40 plus years. And I had vague memories of some conversations in those interviews that would touch on these things. So I said, well, let's find out what's in there. And we got a grant. It's called a FIRE grant, Fostering Interdisciplinary Research something. And we had some students, graduate students and undergrads, scan the archives and identify projects in there where these kinds of issues seem to come up. And we identified several hundred interviews where somebody either talked about an experience with sudden death, or they talked about doctors, or they talked about health in some form or fashion that we thought might be worth pursuing. And so we identified these interviews, and then a colleague of ours at the Odom Institute for Social Sciences actually coded a bunch of these interviews to come up with some themes and things that he could pull out of there.
So, Dr. Simpson, going into this, what do you think you're going to be listening for?
You mean from the oral history?
The oral history program, yeah.
Yeah, it was the most – I actually had a hypothesis. That's what medical people do all the time, that we'd see weak social support, because that was one of the things that we thought was an overriding cause of sudden death, was people weren't well connected with their communities. So that was the idea I went in with. As of most things, the idea you start with isn't the idea you finish with. And we found actually really strong social support, at least in the oral histories that we interviewed.
Yeah, we have an indication of that in one of the samples that we brought with us today. This is a clip from an interview recorded with Vicki Everhart in Stanley County, North Carolina. She and her husband adopted two children from Russia. One of them was in need of a lot of medical care. And in the interview, she describes what happened in the aftermath. Her son got the surgery. It was pretty risky all the way through, and he survived. And let's hear what happened next.
He had to learn everything all over again because he was so, so, so bad. He's a multimillion-dollar kid, literally. And had it not been for the community coming together at that time to help raise funds, Pfeiffer College had two different plays that they put on, and Richfield Elementary had a penny drive, and the fire department had a hamburger dinner, and then they did a cookout. He was the face of every little kid who everybody always thought wouldn't make it, and he's still here.
Now, it's a clip from an oral history interview with Vicki Everhart. It was recorded this summer in Stanley County as part of a new collaboration and a research initiative between the Southern Oral History Program and healthcare providers curious about using oral history to better understand health practices and behavior. So, Dr. Simpson, you went in thinking, well, probably inadequate, broken networks, social networks may be one of the things. We heard in that clip, certainly, there was a robust social network. People were falling behind this family and helping them. Now, that's one story. What do you do from that to probe your hypothesis even further? What did you find out from there?
Well, we certainly haven't given up the hypothesis because there's a lot of reasons this might be a selective story. Right. However, it also did point to us that we needed to be a little more broad-based in our thinking. And that was one thing we got from the oral historians, that we had to think a little more broadly than one or two hypotheses as we did that.
Yeah, Rachel.
Well, I think that's been one of the really fun things about this collaboration, is just learning how someone in a different field approaches a question and a problem. And, as historians, we don't start necessarily with a hypothesis. We gather a lot of evidence and then we build from that up. And so we literally had to get each other to explain how do you think about research and how do you do this? And we struggled at times to understand the way the other person was approaching it, but I think we both really learned a lot. And so that kind of reasoning where we say, well, let's not decide ahead of time that it's, you know, social isolation. Let's listen first to what people are saying and then we'll figure it out was not the way Dr. Simpson was used to it. But for us to think about, okay, but how can these stories, you know, how can we get enough of them to build a, you know, scientifically sound argument? How can we think about comparing across time in ways that will, you know, be sound and make sense? Has been really exciting and challenging.
Yeah, because that points to another part of this project of yours. You used a lot of historic archived interviews, went back, that was back as far as 30 years, but also now you're doing interviews that are directed at this project, right, which changes your methodology, I would think, or you have to think differently about collecting oral history if you've got a point.
Right. Well, in the past, what we were finding in those archives was, yes, there's a lot of really interesting anecdotes about health and doctors and things, but it was never the focus of what the interviewer was interested in. And so often they would just kind of say, oh, that's interesting, and then move on. And we wanted to probe more deeply and be able to spend time with people really thinking about healthcare in their communities or health challenges in that area of the state or their own experiences with healthcare and their families and how those were passed down so that we could delve deeper into these issues.
I want to play another clip from one of the interviews. This one was recorded in 1976, a recording with Josephine Turner. Her husband died at the age of 36 from a heart attack, and at the time of the recording, she was 49 years old and living in Durham.
I wasn't weighing 100 pounds when they put me in the hospital. The doctors had gave me up, and I made a vow to God on my deathbed, you know, if he would let me live, I would serve him and I would be more humble. So he did. He raised me up off that bed in 64. And from that day to this one, I've tried to live the best I know how for God and try to help fellow man. Because I come up on the rough side of my, I know what it is to be poor. I know what it is to have the lights turned off, the water turned off. And I can sympathize with these people. This is what gets me so sadly. When the people of town will sit behind the desks and try to run the lives of the people out here when they don't know what's happening out here. They're not out here. They've never seen the starvation or the sick. They've never went in the hospital and seen these things, and I know they have.
That's a clip from an oral history interview with Josephine Turner, and it's part of a new collaborative research initiative between the Southern Oral History Program and healthcare providers who are curious about using oral history tools to better understand health practices and behavior. I'm here with two of the organizers of the initiative. Rachel Seidman is the director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC's Center for the Study of the American South. Dr. Ross Simpson is the project leader for Sudden, which is a research program investigating sudden death in adults. When you hear a narrative like that or a testimony like that, Dr. Simpson, what does that do for you as a provider, as a doctor? How does that change things for you, or does it? Maybe my big question, the bigger question is, how do you imagine this working for physicians going forward, using these narratives?
Well, I think I agree with everything she said. I think we have to, as physicians, as healthcare providers, we have to know the people. We have to understand what's going on. What are they feeling? What do they think? What are they concerned about? To understand their behaviors and then to understand how they work with the healthcare system. So that's one thing that I did get out of working with Rachel. I mean, she joked a little bit about how we had to communicate, and it took more than a year, I think, before we could understand each other's methods. And that was very positive for both of us.
And these are two people sort of in the academy who are trying to work across disciplines. Imagine a physician and a patient if you talk about communication issues. So, I mean, the struggle to work through that, it seems to me, emblematic of the challenge that you face.
Absolutely. I think that's a great image you just brought forward. I think we, as physicians, have to be able to communicate with patients. Conversely, patients, people, have to be able to effectively understand what physicians are saying and be able to communicate back with the physicians. Right. And that is one thing we did get out of the oral histories, that there seemed to be a lack or poor communication. We used the word instrumental. It was very much a doctor telling a patient something to do or something, a diagnosis. So there seemed to be a weakness there on the patient side as well as the doctor side. And that's that. You asked me earlier what we got out of this that we could intervene with. That's an intervenable point.
But how do you do that? I mean, the patients are not, they're not trained. They don't go to med school. So what do you do about that?
Well, there's programs now in the England and in the UK where they actually use community health workers, people from the community who are volunteers, who actually act as mediators, that actually act as mediators with the healthcare system, with doctors, but then also help engage people who might not be fully engaged with their own community. So this is one thing I did get out of Rachel's work, that there's really more opportunities for intervening than I had thought when I first started this project.
Do you imagine something like this, asking med students to listen to narratives or some engagement along these lines, along the lines of your experience, to be part of medical school?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I work with a lot of students now, and the most interesting project they all want to work with me on is the project with Rachel. They they kind of want to hear what we're doing. They don't understand what we're doing, really, but medical students, particularly early in their career, are very, very motivated for this kind of work.
It seems to me it opens up a whole new field. I mean, you think about what radiologists do. I mean, interpreting images is one thing physicians have to do, right? And interpreting narrative would be another whole skill that would require a different kind of training, it would seem to me. Am I right?
I think there's a tremendous role for historians in medicine.
And what about you, Rachel Seidman? I mean, what does this mean for you? Because you've taken this now to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. You've really shown us many other options for oral history that we hadn't considered before. What have you learned through all of this, and what's next?
Well, I'm really excited about some of the ways we might be able to put this to use. We had a conversation a while ago with someone from Blue Cross Blue Shield, actually, and she was imagining, you know, oftentimes in rural communities, the doctors who are providers didn't necessarily grow up there. They may not even live there. They may live in a nearby city and drive in, and they don't know the community. And she was imagining playing some of these oral histories or creating a website or something for part of the orientation for new doctors as they arrive in a community, if they could listen to even just three interviews from that community, how that might help them understand the issues people there are facing or the ways that they think about their relationship with doctors. So I'm really excited about finding, new ways to work with providers, with people who are trying to figure out how do we make healthcare in our state, in our region, in our country better. And I think there's a lot of people thinking about that now. And I think that regular, everyday people on the ground have ideas that are worth sharing with them.
Dr. Simpson, any insights that you gained from this about sudden premature death?
Oh, absolutely. I think we learned a lot on both sides of this equation, you know, the doctor and the person or the patient. So we've learned a lot. We've actually are designing an intervention right now based on the work Rachel and I have done, and we're actually designing a pilot study. And the pilot study would be in one city in North Carolina, based on some of the information that we've culled from the oral histories.
Great stuff. We'll have you back with the results from that. Rachel Seidman is the director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC's Center for the Study of the American South. Dr. Ross Simpson is a cardiologist and professor of medicine at the UNC School of Medicine, and the project leader for SUDDEN. It's a research program investigating sudden death in adults. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You can find links to their work and the stories at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a musical meditation on grief, loss, and family. The music of Anne Claire is next. Stay tuned.